Welcome back, dear students. In this presentation, we will be discussing transactions and transaction costs. But first, let's take just a moment to discuss bull market versus bear market. You probably already have heard these terms. A bull market is a favorable market normally associated with rising prices, investor optimism, economic recovery, and government stimulus. Whereas a bear market is an unfavorable market, normally associated with falling prices, investor pessimism, an economic slowdown, and government restraint. The terms, well, there's a conventional wisdom and then there's the reality. Bulls charge ahead, right? They throw their opponents up into the air, where bears are reclusive and they hide, but when they do attack, they knock their opponents down with their claws. I don't think that's where they came from, but that's what people tell you. There's an old story about bearskin jobbers, for those of you who are into the etymology, is that the right word, of words and where do words come from? Check it out. And what we see is that a bear market is considered a 20% drop. If it's just a 5, 10, 15% drop, that's called a correction. But an official bear market is a 20% drop. And again, they're going to happen, dear students. History tells us they happen every 3, 4, 5 years. They've been happening in longer time frames. It's been longer time frames, but when they do happen, they're pretty severe. At least it's been the last few, right? So we take a long-term perspective and realize that the United States has been in a 200-year bull market since the Industrial Revolution, and now we're having the Information Revolution or whatever you want to call it. And as I've told you, time and time again, I'm a bull. I'm an optimistic individual when it comes to the markets, realizing that the whole thing could fall apart tomorrow for whatever reason. But if it does, then it doesn't matter where your money is. Slide number 35. Let's take a look at stock transactions. Now, dear students, I'm going to tell you that the only one you really should use is a market order, right? You want to buy it? Buy it. You want to sell it? Sell it. And what the capital markets will do for you, what would the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ and all the others will do for you, is they'll go out and find you a 100 shares of IBM or sell your 50 shares of McDonald's. I mean, it'll happen at the market price. Now, you can say, you know what? I want a certain price. I'm willing to sell. It's selling for $25, but I'm not going to sell until it hits 28. And so you have a limit order, which means once it hits that, it will execute. But it'll only execute at that price or better. I mean, it'll sell maybe for more than 28, but the computer systems are so efficient that it'll, once it hits 28, that's what you'll get. And the same thing is true if you're going to buy. I want to buy it, but it's $25 and I'll only pay you $22 for it. Well, if it ever goes down to 22, you'll get that price. Now, stop losses and stop limits. There's a little confusion between these two because they're very similar. But the idea, students, is that you're trying to set a trigger, a stop. Stop my loss! But they can be used for buying, too. But in general, you sell at a current price, at the current price, once the trigger is reached. Unlike the limit, which says, you know what? I will pay $28, but I'm not going to pay any more. So you're going to get that price, $28, right? Or, I'm sorry, I will sell. I said I used that $28 as a sell. I apologize. Or I will buy at $22. Whereas if you use a stop loss order, then once the trigger point is reached, it then becomes a market order. So you don't know that you're going to get the best price. You're going to get the price you wanted. If you say you will sell at 22, right, I'm sorry, let's go back. A stop loss is normally used to, even though you can use it for other reasons, it normally is used to stop your loss. That's why it's called stop loss, or just a stop order. So say you have a stock that's $25 and you're worried about it dropping precipitously. If it ever hits $22, you can say, I will sell. That's the stop of the loss, right? Stop the loss. I don't want it to lose any more than that. But the problem with a stop loss is that if it drops to 17, that's the price you're going to get. It becomes a market order. Whereas if you use a stop limit, it hits 22, then you have to get 22. You won't get anything less than that. So it becomes a limit order. And so it's confusing, isn't it? All I want you to know is that there are market orders for those of you who want to buy or sell. And then there are these little tricky things like a limit order or a stop loss or a stop limit order that allow you to lock in profits or take advantage of a price decline or a price spike. And let's read together. Although you can use limit orders to buy or sell at the price you want, and stop loss and stop limit orders to lock in profits or protect against losses, remember, they trigger automatically. Systems are very sophisticated. If for some reason you change your mind, you ain't going to get to that computer fast enough or your cell phone to cancel the order. It's going to happen before you can respond. So I'm a big fan of market orders. I just tell you, look, you want to buy the stock, buy it. You want to sell the stock, sell it. Whereas traders tell me they really like the limit orders, stop loss, especially stop loss. And so here is a table from your book that shows the difference between the two. Market order, buy at the best price available when you want to buy, sell at the best price available. Whereas a limit order you'll buy it, but only if it hits this price. You know, I'm not going to buy it for more than 22. But, you know, if it never gets down to 22, you're never going to get it. And the same thing is true. I'll sell it if it goes to 28, but if it never gets to 28, you aren't going to sell. Now, the stop order, the stop loss, and the stop limit order are essentially the same thing, but when a stop order is put in place, it becomes a market order. So it's not a limit. You could say, I'll sell when it hits 22, but if it plummets below 22, you're still going to sell. But in the case of the stop limit, you're saying, once it hits the certain price, then I want it to become a limit order, not a stop loss order. So there's a very subtle difference. And as I said, did you want to buy it? Buy it. You want to sell it? Sell it. But short-term traders, you know, people who are speculating and trying to make a quick buck, they tell me that they use stop orders all the time. They use stop-loss orders all the time. And, just in case they were wrong and it didn't go up, it went down. But if you want, but see, they have no intention of owning the stock. They're renting the stock, which is not true. I mean, they actually own it, but in other words, they have every intention of selling it very quickly, within weeks or who knows, minutes or months, but not years, as we're going to do. We're going to hold on to our stocks for 3, 4, 5 years. Maybe not. Sometimes we make a mistake, but mostly we like to think of our stocks as long-term investments. Slide number 37. Or, you know, more than 3 or 4 or 5 years or 10, 20 years. 37. Now, in chapter 2, which I think is a big mistake, the book goes through the stock transactions in detail. All I want you to do for now is just know these terms, buying on margin and selling short. We will go into the details at the end of the semester because, first of all, I don't want you to do them. And secondly, they're pretty tricky. Buying on margin allows you to borrow money from your broker. Your broker becomes like a bank. And they lend you money so you can enhance your return. Sounds great, right? Yeah, well, it also can enhance your loss, too. So there is maybe a reason for doing this, and we'll discuss that later on. But that's all you have to know, is when you buy on margin, which is not the best term, but that's what they call it, you're borrowing money from your broker to buy stocks. Selling short is tricky, folks. You are borrowing not money, you're borrowing stock. And you're selling that stock in the anticipation, in the hope that the price will go down. What? You're selling stock you do not own? That doesn't sound legal. You can't sell something you don't own. Well, you're borrowing it, and you promise to buy it back. You must buy it back. You have no choice. You are contractually required. You clicked here, you know, or signed a document that said you would do that. And my beef with the book is that they spend far too much time discussing these in Chapter 2, and we don't even know what stocks are yet. So we put this at the end of the semester. And my advice, folks, is never, never sell short. Sure, there are situations that make sense. You think a company's going to go down the porcelain oasis, for example, Sears. But it's very dangerous. You can lose a lot of money very quickly. And Peter Lynch says never sell short. Who is he? We'll discuss him later on. He's one of the best investors the world has ever seen. And who am I to argue with him? There's a decent reason that we'll discuss for buying on margin and allows you to borrow from your portfolio without having to sell your stocks, like a home equity line of credit. But for now, all you have to know are these two terms for this chapter, okay? All you have to know is that you can borrow from your broker to buy stocks. That's called buying on margin. And you can sell stocks that you do not own, borrow stocks and sell them, selling short, and buy them back when the price goes down. You hope the price goes down. If the price goes up, you're going to lose a lot of money very quickly. You've heard buy low, sell high. Well, this is the opposite. We sell high, buy low. Huh? I know. It's tricky. Relax. This is all you have to know, is that you're borrowing stock in the hopes that the stock goes down. All right. Enough of that. Slide 38. Let's talk about transaction costs. Well, folks, transaction costs have come down dramatically. They used to be 1-5% sometimes, and the largest portion was the broker's commission. But now, deep discount internet brokers have driven the commissions down to $7-5 a trade. And a few firms used to offer free trades, but they stopped. But now there's a company called Robinhood, which is currently offering free trades, and they're targeting to millennials, young adults, because it's a mobile app, and we'll see, you know, we'll see if they succeed. How do you make money working for free? Well, there's, you know, obviously Google and Facebook do it, so how do they do it? Well, we'll see. Have transaction costs really gone down? Yes, the answer is yes. But more and more the cost is being hidden from the investor, especially the internet garbage brokers. Now, those aren't my words. This was a gentleman who was a client who called them the internet garbage brokers. I think part of it was to make him feel a little bit better because he was paying a higher commission to us, the company I worked for, $29 a trade. But he, at the same time, had his finger on the pulse of what's going on with these internet brokers, as we'll see in just a moment. An example, a deep discount internet broker, which will remain nameless, Scottrade, offers trades for $7. Now, in the fine print of the broker client broker agreement, which you didn't even read, you clicked on there and said, yes, I read it, is included a provision for allowing the broker to solely utilize exclusive stock dealers and market makers. Remember the discussion from the previous chat? Right. The quoted price that we see is simply the best price available. But at any time, just like the Casas de Cambio, there are dozens of prices quoted. And it used to be people screaming and hollering at one another, but now it's all electronic, as dealers and market makers compete for buy and sell orders. The chosen dealer, the exclusive dealer, the exclusive market maker, doesn't necessarily have the best price. So instead of paying $20, the investor might pay $20.05. So the investor sees the $7 commission on their confirmation. They do not see the extra $5 they paid on a 100-share purchase because of the dealer's markup. Are you with me? You following what's going on? You see there's a kickback involved. Slide number 40. Now, I'm not sure if they still do this, folks, because I haven't talked to Scottrade in a few years now, so I really need to go and ask them. But this is the disclaimer that they would include in each trade confirmation from Scottrade. So this is what you'd get when you, and of course nobody read it, it's all uppercase, and companies are very smart, they know if they use uppercase people won't read it because it's harder to read, but then they can say, look, we put it in uppercase, everybody would read it, knowing full well that they don't read. Uppercase is great for headlines, but it's horrible for text when you're trying to read. So anyway, let's read together. Scott Trade Incorporated receives remuneration for directing orders to particular broker-dealers or market centers for execution. Such remuneration is considered compensation to the firm, and the source and amount of any compensation received by the firm in connection with your transaction will be disclosed upon request. You got the bells in the background. Hey, why is there a Gregorian chant? You know, well, folks, I don't know why I break into Gregorian chant, but whenever I see legalese, I just want to I think of, you know, the Middle Ages and smells and bells and Latin, and you can't understand anything that's going on. Because what are they saying, folks? What's remuneration? Well, that's a fancy word for kickback. What's happening is they're directing their orders to exclusive broker-dealers, market makers. Remember the Casa de Cambio? And they are getting a kickback from the market maker. And in Scott Trade's defense, folks, I'm not trying to just pick on Scott Trade. They prominently disclose this relationship in an email they send you every time you make a trade. Many others hide it, and the customers in the fine print, you know, as long as you signed it, right? The judge isn't going to ask you if you read it. They're just going to ask you if you signed it. Many others hide it in their customer agreement, fine print, and the customers are never aware of the relationship. You understand? Yes. You see the $7 commission. You don't see the $2 or whatever you paid more for. Big. It's not a big deal, folks. It really is not a big deal, but it's there, and you really should know it. And that's how Robin Hood and others make their money, because they ain't making it off of commissions. Slide 41. The Securities Exchange Commission says your broker has a duty to seek the best execution that is reasonably available for its customers' orders. But it's not a guarantee. The SEC requires brokers-dealers to notify their customers if the orders are not routed for best execution. Typically, this disclosure is on the trade confirmation you receive after placing your order, as we just saw on the previous slide. Check out Investopedia's article on this. And determining whether or not a customer got best execution can be very difficult. In fact, it's impossible. Here is an example. This is from a law professor's blog, of the Securities and Exchange Commission trying to enforce the rules and not doing a very good job of it. Exactly. So I think the Securities and Exchange Commission is doing their best to say, you know what, we got to go after these people, but at the same time, we've lowered transaction costs dramatically. We don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Well, there are ways that we could deal with this. Slide 42. They were looking into making the cost more transparent, at least so people would know what's happening, possibly showing the customer the difference between the dealer's price and the best price available at the time of execution. Maybe even showing the total gasp markdown or markup from the transaction. Needless to say, the deep discount brokers cried that it would drive up the cost of commissions and ultimately hurt the consumer, and the proposal died. So, dear students, it is up to you to check if you are getting the best execution. But how can you, a lone investor, determine if you're getting the best price if even the Securities and Exchange Commission has trouble watching over the brokerage companies? The answer is you can't, in my humble opinion. You can't do it. And so the idea is to find somebody you trust and realize that, yes, you're either getting charged a little bit more than you think you are, or pay more, because, for example, the firm I work for, we charge $29 a trade, which, you know, 30 years ago was dirt cheap, because Merrill Stench and Morgan Stupid would charge, they still do, $70, $80, $100 or more for a trade. But now, $29, oh my lord, that's so expensive. But I've checked, I've watched that ticker, and it goes by fast on the computer. I've seen our transactions, and sure enough, our company gives you the best price, but we charge you more. So a company like Scott Trade may not give you the best price, but you're going to pay a whole lot less You just don't know how much more you're paying. It might be 40 cents. I mean, it's probably not a lot, okay? So, and my apologies on going into this rant, but it just irks me. We should at least see what we're paying. But, hey, who am I? Slide 43. And if that weren't enough, dear students, if you think you're going to be able to do day trading or whatever, forget it, folks. High-frequency trading uses computers to transact large numbers of orders at very fast speeds. We're talking millions of transactions within seconds. So if you have a chance, I want you to read Flash Boys by Michael Lewis. It is a great book. If you remember the Liar's Poker, that's him. He's a great writer. Read his stuff. You'll love it. There is little doubt that high-frequency trading has reduced transaction costs, folks. That is not argued. But at the same time, the high-frequency trading firms have been accused of using their ability to transact at the microsecond level to front-run investors, essentially stealing tiny amounts of money from the average retail investor and even large players like mutual funds. Now, folks, some of these mutual funds are huge, and they were not happy. Hey, some of the biggest mutual funds, actually the biggest mutual funds in the country and in the world, fought back through a firm called IEX. They're the exchange. They're now an exchange with like New York Stock Exchange, like NASDAQ, but they're small, but they have some big people behind them. Because what they did is they created a speed bump so that the high frequency firms could not jump in front of you and front run your transaction. So here's a great article. There are dozens, folks. This is just from the LA Times, but these are very good articles about what's going on. It's happening now. It's happening now. And other people are saying, don't worry about it. If they're not taking that much money, and besides, that amount of money that they're taking is going down because they're eating each other's lunch. And in the book Flash Boys, which is actually a few years old now, folks, Michael Lewis will be the first person to tell you no one really knows how much they're sifting off the top of the cream, how much cream they're taking off the top of the dessert or whatever analogy you want to use. But the estimates range from $5 billion a year to $15 billion. So let's take the average, say $9 or $10 billion. It sounds like a lot of money, and it is to you and me. But an economy approaching $18 trillion with a market capitalization of some 20-some trillion dollars is a tiny amount of money, folks. It's not right, but again, we don't want to throw out the good things that high-frequency trading has done for us to just correct this wrong that these companies are getting away with. But this company, IAX, is fighting back with the speed bump, plus there are people who are saying, no, It's really not as much as you think it is, because they're now cannibalizing each other, and eventually it'll go down to almost nothing, which, you know, that's maybe true. We don't know, because it's so opaque. We don't really know how much, but I'm rooting for IEX. And why? Because the big mutual fund companies, if they simply trade amongst themselves, will save retail investors who invest in mutual funds, you know, tons of money. Now, again, it'll save you and I pennies, but we're talking to millions of people, so we're talking a lot of money. So if American funds and Vanguard and Fidelity and T. Rowe Price and the pension funds have gotten behind it, the Texas pension fund, the California pension fund, they've gotten behind IEX, and that's a big enough market right there. If they simply trade amongst themselves and IEX, you know, they earn a reasonable rate of return, then we, as retail investors who invest in mutual funds, will have saved tons of money. Okay? So it's a fascinating, fascinating story. And I really recommend this book to you, because you millennials, you've heard of books, right? You've been to a library, maybe? They'll let you check it out. In fact, you can check it out on your phone. You can read it on your phone. Go to your library, dear students. Slide number 44. Okay, round lots, odd lots. Folks, this is old. Eesh. Technology has gotten rid of this. But it's still in the language, and we need to learn it, and I'm sure they'll ask you on the Series 7 if you ever take the stockbroker exam. A round lot is 100 shares or multiples of 100 shares. And odd lots are less than 100 shares. Now, why is this cool? Because in the olden days, you know, before about 10 years ago, when there were still traders on the floor yelling at one another, they would yell 25, and they'd put their hands, push their hands out at away from themselves. And that meant they wanted to sell 100 shares at $25 a share. Because they're pushing it. They're pushing it away. They're putting it to somebody. If they put their hands towards themselves, and I'm doing it and you can't see me, of course, but if they took their hands and pulled them toward themselves and said 25, that meant they wanted to buy 100 shares at $25 a share. If they said 2 at 25, and then depending on what motion they used, it meant they would sell or buy 200 shares, two round lots. You see, so it made trading faster for the humans. And then if they said 17 shares at 25, that meant they had an odd lot and they only wanted to sell or buy 17 shares. So they would charge you extra money for the odd lot, and it's called the odd lot differential. And it used to be, I know it's going to be hard to believe, 12 and a half cents to 25 cents. Yeah, don't ask. But they used to trade in eighths. But not anymore, folks. And now it's less than 5 cents, maybe a penny, 2 pennies. So don't worry about it. On 80 shares, you might be talking about 40 cents or $2. It's not a big deal. But you will hear people say, no, you should always buy in 100 lot purchases. I mean, round lot purchases. Tell them they're out to lunch, because this is, technology has made this obsolete, because it's all computerized now. You type in the number you want, you can buy or sell, and boom, they match the orders electronically, so who cares? But you should know it, and I'm going to ask you on the exam. Slide 45. Where do we get our data? Well, different sources will contain some, all, or more of these statistics. And we're going to ask you in chapter 5 assignment to go out and do some stock quoting and do some research. Remember that most people use the internet. And remember that you are looking at the prices 15, 20 minutes ago. Unless you pay extra, you're not getting the current prices. And remember that there are many prices available. You're just seeing the best price at that time. So what is the dividend yield, the P.E. ratio, volume? We'll take a look at these when we do our, not all these, when we do our assignment for Chapter 5. Slide 46, the Wall Street Journal. People ask me, well, do you use the Wall Street Journal in your class? You need to use the Wall Street Journal. In fact, every couple of months I get a felicitation from them to use, because they know I teach this stuff, to use it in class. And I tell you, I don't think the Wall Street Journal is that good anymore. It has lost a ton of their people. It is now run by Fox News, which tells you right there what their bias is. And, oh my God, you mean you actually wait until the next day to find out how much your stock is worth? Oh, how 20th century. Yeah, all the other newspapers still, they got rid of their stock quotes years ago because of the internet. Yeah, but if you want to check out the Wall Street Journal, check out the Wall Street Journal. Remember, Fox News. Slide 47. this is where you're going, right? You millennials, especially millennials, you're going to go online. And so, what are some of the good online internet finance websites? Excuse me. Well, the best one, folks, and we are so sad about its death, is Yahoo Finance. The best one was, I should say, the best one was for many years Yahoo Finance, but they have literally destroyed the page. They've destroyed the rest of Yahoo, in my humble opinion, but, you know, I don't know what, I don't know why. And in fact, I sent an email to the CEO of Verizon, because that's who owns Yahoo now, complaining, never thinking that, you know, the CEO would actually read it. I do that whenever I have a complaint. I send it to the CEO, and then some underling deals with it. But I got an email back the next day from the CEO, and I forget his name. But it turns out he used to live right across the street from Southwestern Community College. So he spoke fondly of his time there and thanked me. He knew, I mean, most people don't know about Southwestern Community College unless you live here in San Diego. And he said, we'll look into it. We're going to do our best to make it that, you know, he gave the same thing that other people say. But it's horrible. It actually has been destroyed. And it's so sad because it used to be so cool. A lot of people tell me, like, Bloomberg. I don't think Bloomberg is that great, but you check it out. Plus, they, you know, they're going to try to sign you up for their pay version, and supposedly the pay version is very good. I've never used it, so I don't know, but other brokers tell me, oh, yeah, that's all they use is Bloomberg. MarketWatch is the free version of the Wall Street Journal website. The Wall Street Journal website is for pay. You have to pay to use it. Plus, it's very similar to the Wall Street Journal, which is very different from MarketWatch. MarketWatch, I don't know, it's owned by the Wall Street Journal, but it is not Fox News. I mean, they have both sides, and you read the right wing people attack anybody who doesn't go along their lines, and so it's not the same as Fox News. So it's actually not that bad. Morningstar is pretty good. Morningstar started out with mutual funds, and now they're doing stocks. But again, they're going to try to sign you up for the $20, $50 a month. What I use now is Google Finance. It is incredibly rudimentary, dear students. Google, many years ago, said they would never have a sophisticated finance page, and they weren't lying. But it gives the most important data, and then for the really important data, I go elsewhere. We'll see. We'll talk about the value line in the next chapter. So you decide which one, and then there are others, folks. CNBC. There are many others, folks. I'm not thinking of them right now, but go to the presentation on the website. It's there. It's there where I show you Google and Bloomberg and Morningstar and MarketWatch, and you decide which one you want to use. And you will use this, or you could go to the library. Remember the library? They have very cool resources at the library. And look up the information you need to know for Chapter 5 assignment. Because that's what you're going to do. You're going to look up some stocks. And I have some list of stocks I want you to look up. But then I want you to look up some of your own. The companies that speak to you. The companies that you're interested in. Okay? All right. So, that's our presentation on transactions, transaction costs, and stock quotes. In our next presentation, finally, finally, we will get to these market indices, these market averages, the S&P 500, the Dow Jones, the NASDAQ, and we will finally define things that we've been using since the beginning of the semester. And that's a little strange, but that's how it works. Okay? So, are you learning? Are you getting an education? I hope so, dear students. We want this to be the best class you have ever taken. We want this class to help you in life, in this adventure we call life, and that 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now, you think, you know what? This thing actually did help me. So, see you in our next presentation. Comments, criticism, suggestions, feedback. We need them. We want them. We'd love to hear from you. We want you to be awesome. See ya.